From the Southeast Asian capital city of the Philippines, Manila, I bid you good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever the case may be, wherever you are. I'm Art Bell for George Norrie, sitting in this evening. He's getting a well-deserved night off. It's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to be back every now and then. So there you have it. We've got an interesting evening ahead of us. Peter Ward will be here, a well-credentialed man indeed, who will talk to us about the oil spill and the environment and global warming and all that sort of stuff. So get ready, because here it comes. Let's look at a few items. Number one, yes, we just had a couple of earthquakes here in the Philippines. Didn't feel them here in Manila, for the record. But they were 7.3 and 7.4 in Mindanao, down toward Cotabato. And so that's, you know, that's like 550 or 60 miles or more from here. So we didn't feel a thing. And believe me, on the 19th floor, we feel anything that happens. All the ABs are well indeed. In fact, we've got a picture up of Asia that I think you'll love. I took this yesterday, so that's how recent it is. And you'll find it right on the front page of the coasttocoastam.com website. Simply go there, click on the little picture of Asia, and then that's going to take you to another page. And then you click on that one, and it gets bigger. And it's really pretty. She is a doll. She is 3 months, 3 years and 2 months old now. And boy, is she doing well. She already has two or three boyfriends, and she's in school. Now, here they start school very, very early. So she is in preschool, and she goes 5 days a week, has a little school uniform and the whole thing. So they start very, very early here, apparently, in more ways than one. I've got a little bit of news. I didn't want to say anything about this until I successfully did it, in case I didn't. But in America, we have several classes of amateur radio. You know, I'm a ham operator. It's a big deal for me, right? And we have a reciprocal agreement here in the Philippines with the United States. So if you have a ham license in the U.S., then you automatically are granted privileges here. But, of course, you know, you're kind of a port. You're a D1/W6OBB in my case. So I thought I would take a try at passing the Class A test here, which is equivalent to the extra exam in the U.S. And it's kind of tough because they ask different questions. Not only do they ask different questions, but everything's in the metric system. So it takes a lot of conversion and thinking about the answers and the formulas and such. Anyway, I passed. So I will be among a handful, maybe perhaps two hands at the most that you could count, of Americans here that have taken and passed the Class A test. Now, at the same time, I would like to congratulate my wife, who passed the Class C test, equivalent to a technician class in the United States. Actually, a little better in a sense that you can use the HF bands except for 20 meters. So she is going to be a licensed Philippine ham shortly, or technically, I guess she is now, but they will issue call letters shortly. And I'm kind of hoping, I'm going to request a 4F1 call, which is pretty rare prefix. I just found out you can get them, and so I'm going to request a 4F1 prefix instead of a DU1. But either way, I did it. So that means no more portable this or that, because I'll be an actual licensed Class A ham here in the Philippines, which is, I don't know, pretty cool. Just did it pretty much to see if I could do it and get a shorter call and that kind of stuff. So I'm pretty happy with myself. Did it at a ham fest. The National Telecommunications Commission came and gave a test, and damned if I didn't pass. We had a typhoon last week. Yep, a typhoon. It was only a Category 1, but it nevertheless killed 111 people here. and did about 500 million pesos worth of damage. That's a lot of damage, actually. All right, looking very briefly at the world news, never all that much of a pleasure. North Korea is, again, threatening. And, you know, I'm starting to wonder. Anyway, says North Korea threatened Saturday to mount a powerful nuclear response to upcoming joint U.S.-South Korean military drills. We have those every year, calling them an unpardonable provocation on top of wrongly blaming Pyongyang for the sinking of a South Korean warship. North Korea's powerful National Defense Commission, led by the ever-present leader Kim Jong-il, warned that its troops would counter the move to hold U.S. military maneuvers involving a nuclear-armed U.S. supercarrier with a retaliatory sacred war. Now, you know, North Korea blusters a lot, and so you get sort of hardened to their words after a while. But this sounds unusually ominous to me. You know, in the face of the sinking of the South Korean warship, you have to put a little bit of money down on the possibility that they actually might do something really stupid. Most nations, you'd shrug and you'd say it's a bunch of baloney and rhetoric, which it normally is from North Korea, but I'm not sure this time, so you might want to keep a close eye on that. Now, tropical depression now, Bonnie, is headed straight to the oil spill site, kind of like iron filings to a magnet. Ships relaying the sights and the sounds from BP's broken oil well stood fast Friday on the leftovers of Tropical Storm Bonnie blew straight for the site, threatening to force a full evacuation that would leave engineers clueless about whether a makeshift cap on the gusher was holding. Vessels connected to deep-sea robots equipped with cameras and seismic devices would be among the very last to flee, and they would, in fact, ride out the rough weather if possible. Unbelievable. A friend of mine last night asked, what have the people in the Gulf done to deserve all of this? A California town apparently is quite outraged to learn of its officials paying the ought to be. Bell, California, of all places. Residents in this modest blue-collar L.A. suburb, where one in six people live in poverty, were angry. Their city manager, it seems, was paid more than President Barack Obama. Their police chief, more than the commander of the nearly 13,000-member LAPD. They demanded, got the manager, chief, and another high salaried official to, I guess, retire, quit, otherwise go find employment elsewhere. Facebook is turning in. My wife is a Facebook addict. Absolute addict. A Facebook feud between two women who claim to love the same prison inmate led to a high-speed chase and a crash. It's not funny, really. That critically injured one of the rivals, killing her friend, left the second rival facing murder charges. Tori Emery, arraigned Friday in Pontiac's 50th District Court on multiple felonies, as friends of the dead woman were holding a car wash to pay for her funeral. Zsa Zsa Gabor, by the way, in critical condition. So looking around the world, it doesn't look that hot. Well, actually, it does. It's quite hot. June, the month of June, was the Earth's hottest month in all of recorded history. Yeah, that's right. All of recorded history. Had to get this news from France. Last month was the hottest June ever recorded on Earth, according to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, but published in France. adding to global warming worries, the combined global land and ocean surface temperature data also found the January through June and April through June periods were the warmest on record. That's all-time record, folks, according to NOAA's National Climate Data Center, which based its findings on measurements that go back all the way to 1880. And from the, the whole world's point of view, I guess 1880 is not that long. But for as long as we've been keeping records, it would be the very hottest. I am not going to read this, but I will ask our upcoming guest, Peter Ward, about it. Dr. Ward, I bet most of you have seen it. And it ran around the internet and scared the hell out of everybody, including me. It was an article entitled "How BP Gulf Disaster May Have Triggered a World-Killing Event," an Ellie. Right? I don't know that the BP disaster is going to, of course, I don't know it's not either, going to do such a horrible thing, but it was a long, interesting, somewhat technical article, and it actually scared me. I sent it to some friends and let them review it, and scared them too. So I would imagine quite a number of you have seen this article, and we'll try and talk about it a little bit. Again, if you get the opportunity, go up and see the picture I took of Miss Asia yesterday, posted now on the internet for your viewing pleasure. 3 years and 2 months. Boy, they grow up so quickly. So quickly. I mean, this is just unbelievable. Anyway, she has an attitude, a girl attitude. Am I pretty? Can I buy a dress? A green dress is the latest wish. Unbelievable. All right, so Peter Ward coming up in a moment. Once again, I'm Art Bell for George Norrie, who's taking a well-deserved night off. When you do this 5 or 6 nights a week, believe me, a night off is a refreshing thing to experience, and so I'm glad he's getting it. Coming up now is Peter Ward, who is a professor of biology, a professor of earth and space sciences, an adjunct professor of astronomy at the University of Washington in Seattle. Very well credentialed, huh? He is principal investigator of the University of Washington node of the NASA Astrobiology Institute, which involves the leadership of over 25 scientists studying the probability of finding life beyond the Earth. He is also senior counselor of the Paleontological Society and was awarded an affiliate professorship at the California Institute of Technology. So lots and lots and lots of creds for Dr. Ward. Peter Ward, Dr. Peter Ward, welcome to back to Coast to Coast AM.
It is so nice to hear your voice on the radio, and I think there are many millions listening right now who are saying, "Art, we love that voice. We love to have you." So I'm just honored to be here.
Thank you. It's hard to even know where to begin, but I guess with the oil spill, do you have any late word, Doctor, on how Bonnie or the remnants of the tropical storm, now a tropical depression, will affect it? It's really just headed in the worst direction it could be going, up off the coast of Florida right now, going west northwest, headed straight for the spill. 35-mile-an-hour winds or so, but it's going to really rough up the water, and one can only imagine what it's going to might do to the beaches. I don't know.
Well, it's kind of good news, bad news. I mean, the rough water, at least it's going to break up that oil into smaller blobs that dispersants can get a piece of. But once it gets on the beach, the bad news, of course, the wind hits it, the oil goes on the beach, and then you blow the sand on the oil. And it's just like, when you put the sunscreen on and then you get in the sand, oh, you're like all gooey. Those beaches become all gooey. Unfortunately, it stays a long time, too.
Well, I want to talk a little bit. You said it might break it up even more about the dispersants. There's a lot of controversy about these dispersants, Doctor. And I wondered too. I mean, I don't know how approved they were. Well, in fact, I got a little email about it. Dear Mr. Bell, hoping to get your show before Peter Ward. Since there is a question regarding the distance that the hurricane winds might go into the U.S., please ask him what would be the safest, if any, if these winds get all the way up to the Great Lakes. I doubt that. I'm afraid the discussion that the oil dispersant being the biblical wormwood might be true. Now, I doubt it's that bad, a biblical wormwood, but what can you tell me, Doctor, about the dispersant being used? What do you know about it, if anything?
Well, that's kind of scary to a lot of us. I mean, you're putting in some really heavy-duty stuff. To break oil up like that, you've got to have some major chemicals. And because organisms, in many cases, are made up of hydrocarbons not that dissimilar from oil, I mean, look, every single cell of any organism on this planet, its outer cell wall is made up of something called a lipid. It's very close to what you're finding in a lot of these oils. So, yeah, we're breaking up the oil, but what are we doing to the plankton? I mean, we're ripping the heck out of the interior of really the base of the food chain out there. And this is where people are out there right now. They're strained. Well, not right now. They're off the water. But a lot of science, a lot of mainline science is being conducted now to find out exactly. It could be the dispersants are actually going to do way worse damage ecologically than the oil, if that's possible.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, it's just such a lose-lose proposition, everything about this. It's just heartbreaking.
Yes, it is. Well, all of the networks have been sending out their correspondents, those that don't get stopped by BP guards or, you know, whoever it is stopping the media, and I know they're not very media-friendly out there. When they do get out, they don't, I mean, they see a little oil. You see strips of oil and stuff like that, but frankly, if what they're saying is true, what, 100 million, 200 million, somewhere in that range, gallons of oil have gone into the Gulf, you would expect to see large, gigantic areas of oil floating on the surface. And we're not seeing that at all, or very little of it, sort of more like strips floating on the surface. And most of us, including me, have the feeling that the majority of this oil is underwater because of the dispersants. Now, if it had been above water, that great big super skimmer that they brought along would have been able to skim it up. But they used the super skimmer for, what, several days or a week or something, and all they got was water. They didn't skim any oil because basically it wasn't there. So it has to be somewhere. 100 million gallons or more has to go somewhere, right?
Well, I agree. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. My biggest single worry has been, where's the heavy stuff? You know, once we have oil coming out, you think it's all the same stuff. It's not. In a barrel of oil, there's gasoline that you could use in your car once you refine it. There's really light stuff you can use as jet engines and kerosene. But there's also the really heavy sludge. I mean, this is the stuff that it becomes motor oil or worse, or lubricants or worse. This heavy stuff doesn't float. I mean, you're talking about some really dense, yucky stuff that is sitting down there on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. And my single greatest fear is that it's kind of like Steve McQueen's first movie. You know that one, The Blob, right? Big, fat, black blob sitting at the base of the channels down there, and it's just sitting there. And they're sending submarines down. They had this big NBC, big brouhaha, oh, we sent down a reporter down to 50 feet or whatever. They're not going to the right place. They're really not looking where that oil, I think, should be. That whole Gulf region already has suffered what we call these low oxygen or dead zones. And the dead zones were there before the oil. You add the oil to the dead zones, and you're really looking at an ecological disaster at depth.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I saw the NBC, the first report. Last I heard, they said they were, I'm a day behind, headed for the off the Florida coast somewhere to look for oil. But just about everybody who goes out to look for it really doesn't find it. Now, 100 to 200 million gallons of oil, that's got to be somewhere. So I guess, do you actually know the chemical makeup, or is it a secret, kind of like the Coke formula? I mean, they're not telling us, right?
No, there's just The other scary thing is, however much they say is out there, and the fact that the officials are saying the 100 million gallon, it's so scary because that's really the tip of the iceberg. This thing is way bigger than that. Look, BP is going to be fined for every barrel they let loose, so of course they're going to lowball. They've always lowballed this thing. There's just so much oil down on that bottom, and we are going to find this stuff sooner or later. And it's not the oil that scares me. It's what the oil turns into. And the two really worst byproducts are hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg stuff, and methane.
Oh, methane. We're going to get to methane. All right, Dr. Hold it right there. Professor Peter Ward is my guest. I'm filling in for George Norrie from Manila, Philippines. I'm Art Bell. Here I am. By the way, we're right in the middle of the rainy season here and the flu season here. It occurs during this time of the year. Fortunately, we got our flu shots. My daughter is in school with 14 other children, and the other day there were only 4 of them present. So that gives you some idea of the spread of flu over here. So this year, we were thanking goodness that we got our flu shots, kind of a combination of H1N1 and the regular yearly flu, which is what I think is going around right now. So imagine that, 10 out of 14 not in class because of the flu. Makes you feel good to get the shot. All right, Dr. Peter Ward is my guest. We're discussing the Gulf oil spill. Somebody objected to the word spill. He said when you spill coffee, that's a spill. I don't know. He doesn't suggest what it ought to be called. It's a disaster. It's a lot of things, and it's awful. But it's hard not to call it the Gulf oil spill. I don't know. I'll think about it. Maybe there's another name that's more appropriate. Want to talk about methane? We'll do that with Dr. Peter Ward in a moment. Tom in Oregon City, Oregon says, "Hey, Art, more BS global warming from you. You need to do some research. The friggin' temperatures are bad. You, Art, are a hopeless dupe." Dr. Ward, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's good to be in the company of another hopeless dupe. All right. So, you know, we'll get to the global warming stuff in a bit. But actually, in a way, we are now anyway. Methane. The pictures when the oil was coming out showed sort of a combination of black-colored oil and very light-colored or white-colored methane. There was a hell of a lot of methane coming out of that well for a long time. There are articles on the internet that will scare you to death, like this one. I don't know if I'm sure you saw it from Earth Science. How BP Gulf disaster may have triggered a world-killing event. Pretty strong stuff and a long article. Did you read that?
You know, it's strange you say that because I was on with Ian on several days after it started, and I said, "Hey, Ian, you know about methane? This could blow up Miami." And he goes, "You're kidding." I said, "No, this guy Riskin, I've known about this guy for 10 years. You know, a lot of us have known and tried to say, this guy's got a really cool story." I mean, I had to laugh a lot because Coast to Coast had this story 3 months ago.
Yeah, it's been around for a while, I know.
Well,
I know.
Way before that, I'm sure you and I have chatted about this, at least off air. I mean, this has been a long time, and just people, they don't believe it because they say it's just too awful to be true, but there's a lot of truth to it.
Well, I'm not sure it's too awful to be true. Actually, historically, things like this in the world certainly have occurred previously, so is it really too awful to be true, or... I mean, where's all that methane going? It's pretty much lying on the bottom, isn't it?
Well, the methane, most methane's a really light gas. And when you see that stuff coming out, what happens, the reason you don't see it, it dissolves in seawater really fast. I mean, it just does. Gas dissolves in. But it makes its way to the surface once the concentration is high enough. And then methane pops into the atmosphere. It doesn't last long, about 15 years, 10 years. And then it turns into a bunch of carbon dioxides. So methane is like this. Methane is a greenhouse gas on steroids. Methane is like the bantam, but toughest guy out there for making the atmosphere warmer. All that methane we are pumping up is just making your global warming skeptics, I think, full of hot air. I don't want to say that. Mix the metaphors, but it is going into the atmosphere and making things hotter and hotter and hotter.
Now, oh, I recall.
Blow up.
Do you recall? I think it was in Africa, wherever it was. There was a lake in which.
Lake Nyos, 1982. Yeah, very
right. Well, that methane. Exactly that methane apparently was on the floor of the lake, or somehow stored and then released all at once. Right.
Yep, it's just a great big burp, and that burp is both methane and carbon dioxide, and it killed 2,000 people and 8,000. Cows, and they were much more worried about the cows initially because that's the whole economy. But what in one night, and it's just a silent, awful killer. But Riskin talks about this. This guy from Northwestern University, had it been pure methane, and his thought is if the Black Sea burps out its methane content, prevailing winds blow it up over China, a lightning strike hits, and it takes China off the map because you've burned it completely out of existence.
Okay. I know scientists are down in the Gulf now doing trying to do all kinds of measurements, trying to figure out where the oil is, what sort of effect the dispersants are having and all the rest of it, and they're having a hell of a hard time doing it. So I guess you can't tell me the current state of the Gulf. We really don't know, do we?
We don't, and I must take this moment to complain about our government because my group has tried to get one of these grants to work on this. Here's the catch-22. They announced to all of us that we have $20 million we're about to give out in grants of $200,000 apiece for fixing it or studying it. So my group is we work on hydrogen sulfide. So we want to see what happens if you put oil in sediment and let it sit there for years, it turns into this very poisonous gas. How quickly and what does it do to seagrass? Seagrass is where all the baby fish and all the food fish and all the invertebrates spend their early days. You know, it's the daycare center for productive fish. After 20 years, that oil is going to turn into poison that kills us off. So we went to the government and they said, well, you can't turn in the grant until you get an email from us saying that you can turn in the grant. So we wait and wait and wait, and the deadline goes by. And they said, well, we just didn't have enough people employed to take care of you guys. So sorry, we can't do anything for you. I mean, this is a true story, Art.
Oh, I no problem believing in it at all, unfortunately.
Yeah, I had a chance. Our group, I think, could really make a contribution to deciding what areas is triage. What areas in the Gulf where the seagrass grows should we say, look, there's so much oil and hydrogen sulfide, it'll never come back in a long time, dig it out, versus those say, well, that's kind of marginal, that will probably come back, and we have a way of studying that. And they said, oh, we're too busy, we can't get to you right now. Mm-hmm. Whatever.
We just found out that the last few months were like the hottest months ever recorded on the face of the globe in all of recorded history. Now, whenever we do anything that deals with global warming, we get these kinds of messages from some people who are not just anti-global warming. They are, God, what's the right way to phrase it? Not only do they refuse to believe it, but they hate anybody who seems to believe it. Now, I know there was a controversy, of course, with the scientists and the emails and all the rest of it. And despite the vindication since in the investigation of those scientists, people still use it to say, the whole thing's a damn hoax. Well, let's talk about it a little bit. Is it a hoax or is it irrefutably settled science?
There's no such thing as irrefutably settled science in the sense that there's always the chance that something might go haywire on us. But in this particular case, look, the thing about the media is you always have to have the opposite side of things. Well, let's do a story about gravity. I mean, who's going to take, but then there's still these people who think that gravity makes things go up, not down. You know, we don't do that. We've settled that. And global warming, it is settled. It is settled that a greenhouse gas warms the atmosphere. It is settled in my field that if you go back through deep time, I'm way back, you can detect from the rocks what was the CO2 level, what was the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And how warm was the planet? Just by seeing, are there fossil deposits of ice sheets? Do we find the evidence, geological evidence, of fossil ice sheets? Times of high CO2, we never find ice. Times of low CO2, we have ice ages. I mean, you can't be more settled than that. We know that 1,000 parts per million, we're at 390 now and growing, 1,000 parts per million in the past has never had continental ice sheets. In other words, you don't have the equivalent of Antarctica or the equivalent of Greenland. You know, what floats on the ocean is irrelevant. The entire sea level flooding story comes from what is on land. So it's Greenland and Antarctica which dictate sea level rise, which, by the way, is the single most important aspect of global warming. We think about the heat, but it's sea level that's going to bankrupt us. And I hope we can go into that story.
Well, we will. We all know the North Pole is well into melting. It's, I forget, 40, 50% gone, something like that. The whole North Pole.
Going, gone. That's right.
Right. What is the state of Greenland in terms of melt?
Greenland is going very fast. Greenland itself, if all of it melts, all of its ice cover, the sea level goes up to 20 to 24 feet. Since I've talked to you, Art, I've become, even in my old age, I've become an Antarctic explorer. I've been down there twice now in the last year and a half. I was able on two cruises, and I had to live in this tent of mine for 40 days on the ice, which was a very interesting experience. But what was just shocking is how fast the glaciers are retreating there and how quickly Antarctica is becoming essentially Greenland. We were watching the colonization of Antarctica by green plants in the Antarctic Peninsula. The role of the science I'm doing down there is to really try to discover at what level of CO2 can there still be ice. You know, if sea level rises even 3 feet, 3 feet is a catastrophe for world agriculture. 3 feet also changes every dock, every wharf, every single airport that is at sea level. And Manila Airport, I think, is really right down by the ocean, as is Hong Kong, and as is Sydney, as is L.A., as is San Francisco, on and on and on. The money it will take for a 2 or 3 foot sea level change is going to make what happened in the housing market just look like a pittance. I mean, we are really looking at a major catastrophe just from sea level change, and you're absolutely right. Hottest June on record. Come on. I mean, how can you say this isn't happening?
I don't know. It's denial. A lot of people, of course, are in denial about any bad news, and a lot of people are in denial about anything that will force them to change the way they live. So that turns into anger. And, you know, I see a lot of it. Whenever we do a program on anything like this, you just get inundated with all this anger. So it is, without saying indisputable or whatever, it is pretty much settled science. And the big brouhaha over the emails, it was damaging. There's no way to suggest it was not damaging, even though there's been vindication since. The timing, by the way, was sort of suspect, wasn't it, right before the big conference?
Well, I was interested to notice that it was front page news everywhere. But when the big investigations finished and vindicated every one of those controversies, it was page 10 news. It's really interesting how that asymmetry came about. And so you are left with the impression, lots of people read the front page and hear the front page news, which is the equivalent of sort of the Fox News, let's take it off. Oh, they went crazy. But Fox News never even mentioned vindication.
I know.
Not even a word.
I know. Doctor, we should have been on alternative energies back in the 70s. We should have had the wake-up call then. We should have begun lots and lots of, all kinds of alternative energy. At this point, here we are in 2010, and we never really got started. I mean, there were a few solar panels that went up in the White House, came back down again when Ronald Reagan got in there. I thought we were going to take off then, but we didn't. And what I'm concerned with is when we finally get to crunch time, unless we've already passed crunch time, and we may have, it's going to be too late. it's simply going to be too late. And is it yet too late, or are we close to that point?
Too late to me is when we have the first of the enormous global mortality moments. I mean, when we have a giant mortality episode. And I think, I'm afraid that it may actually take that before people really take it seriously. But, you know, it's funny you talk about the alternative energy that was seen in the 70s. Here's something else that you and I really knew and saw everywhere in the 70s, an organization called ZPG, Zero Population Growth. It was all over then, and it has been gone now for 20 years. I got very curious, who killed ZPG as well as the electric car? Turned out the ZPG was killed by the Bush administration. They made a devout effort, in reality, to wipe it off. It was said, look, we cannot have global population planning, and the net effect is that by 2050, by 2060, we have 9 billion people. We had the chance. We had to do two things. We had to reduce energy, but we also had to reduce population. And in the 1970s, we had the chance. Both of those. Not just one will do. You had to do both. We did neither.
I really had hopes for a while there in the 70s that we were going to proceed, that solar panels would be everywhere, the Nevada, Arizona deserts would fill up with solar panels. We'd have nuclear energy and all kinds of non-polluting energy going on. There were so many ways we could have done it. And yet, even today, after the Gulf oil spill, after everything has happened, you don't hear a big movement toward anything of that sort. Nothing at all. I mean, if the Gulf oil spill didn't do it, if that didn't wake us up, as you point out, only, I guess, some sort of extinction event may do it, or partial extinction event of some sort. What is most likely? Just speculating, Dr. Ward.
Well, without flogging, I actually published a brand new book called The Flooded Earth. And the trouble with it is that I had to swing for the fences, so I began to look at the hot spots. And what happens, the worst hot spot of all is Bangladesh. If you raise sea level 3 feet, so by 2100, you've got a 3 to 5 foot sea level rise. In Bangladesh, you lose about 20-30% of the living area, but you lose way more of the agricultural area because salt goes sideways. People think, oh, man, sea level rise, that's going to cover over where I live. Well, yes, but it does a worse thing. It goes sideways through soil, and it takes productive soil and makes it impossible to grow anything. Bangladesh, 110 million people, feeds itself well now because they can rotate three crops. A 3-foot to 5-foot sea level rise, Bangladesh reduces the agricultural output by a third, while the population will have gone up by a third to a half again. That equation means that Bangladeshis are going to have to go to India. India has nukes. Bang. I mean, there you go. That scenario has been posited. But actually, there's 2 or 3 books out. I thought I was the first, and the book I just came out July 1st. And I'm not the first, but it is. The CIA worries about it. The Department of Defense worries about it. There are white papers about here. It is the trigger points where people without living space and not enough food get pushed into somebody else's country and bang.
Well, you're absolutely right about Bangladesh. But, you know, people in the U.S., and the U.S. still is a very powerful country, although the world is now being, certainly is shifting. I heard that now China uses more energy than the United States, so they have passed us already in that category. Bangladesh would disappear very quickly. But people in the U.S., yeah, it's Bangladesh. It's so far away. And, yeah, they're used to hearing tragic stories about lots of people getting killed in Bangladesh and Africa and places like that, and it just sort of rolls off.
Well, also in my book, I posit a night in which 1 million people die in the Low Countries. We have the perfect storm where it is 2120 and you're in Holland and the dikes give way, and Holland is already so low anyway. 1 million people in Europe dying would certainly wake people up.
Oh, anything in Europe, North America, perhaps Japan, that would wake people up. But, you know, in the poorer third world countries, Bangladesh and other countries, like even here in the Philippines, other countries like that, they're used to hearing about disasters of this and that sort and high numbers of people dying. In fact, we had a very mild, relatively mild typhoon pass right over Manila. The eye came right over and 111 people died. And I'm sure it barely even made the news. Dr. Ward, hold on. We're at yet another break point. We'll continue. Dr. Peter Ward, global warming, methane, the mess in the Gulf, all of it to be discussed throughout the night from Manila in the Philippines. I'm Art Bell.